Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Holy cow, let me set the levels right. Somebody must have come in and cleaned up the board over the weekend because everything is knocked all over the place. 6 minutes past the hour. Happy Monday. It's 9-11. 9-11. Indeed. Doug McKinnon is with us. He's with townhall.com, the former top aide to former Senator Bob Dole and a former top White House and Pentagon aide, and townhall.com, as I recall, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, the website that William F. Buckley started.
Yeah, it's doing quite well, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show. I guess I don't know the exact numbers, but I think right now they're getting about 1.6 million unique hits a month. So it's growing, and a lot of conservatives are paying attention, but also just, you know, a lot of the mainstream media is reading it as well.
Yeah, not too shabby. In your most recent column, Homegrown Terrorists, Doug McKinnon, you talk about how if you take the 6 million U.S. Muslims and just skim off 1% of them, that's 60,000, well, to quote you, that translates into 60,000 dangerous people running around in our country. Why would you think that 1% of American Muslims are dangerous?
Well, I didn't say that in the column, actually, Tom. I don't know who gave you that.
It was apparently from Mark Coyle, who is your...
Oh, no. I wrote the column, and Mark forwarded it, but I didn't say, you know, 60,000 would be dangerous. What I say in my column is, you know, there's a possibility. If you agree with me, and I certainly do, I've got Muslim friends that 99% are good, wonderful, loyal Americans, and then 1% may be, what I say, may be in the column suspect, then that maybe number would be about 60,000. And then I also say, if you agree with me that 99.9% of all Muslim Americans are good, loyal Americans that, you know, want to defend the country, then that, you know, 0.1% would translate to 6,000 Muslim Americans. And my whole point, Tom, is just basic common sense, is doesn't it behoove us to wonder if, you know, if we may have homegrown terrorists, you know, as they're finding they have in England?
Well, we do have homegrown terrorists, Mark, Doug McKinnon.
Right.
I mean, you know, we do. The largest cache of weapons and explosives, enough to easily bring down another Oklahoma City building and probably to bring down the World Trade Center if it was planted appropriately at the base of it, was found in Texas about a year and a half ago. And it was a white supremacist.
Well, that's right. And you know, my whole feeling is, you know what, let's go after them incredibly vigorously, but at the same
token. Well, we are.
Well, and we should. But also what I'm just saying is, you know, let's not let political correctness keep us from, you know, enforcing the law and looking after people that may be, again, may be a threat to the United States. It just seems to be common sense to me. But if you raise the subject, then unfortunately some people on the left immediately scream, you know, civil rights violations, and we can't do that, and we can't monitor our own people. And again,
who are those people on the left, Doug?
It's been on the air time and time again. And
can you give me one name?
Well, I every time I write one of these columns, I get flooded with emails, and sometimes most of them hate mail, saying, you know, gee, you know, Mr. McKinnon, you can't do this. We can't go after Muslims just because we can't target a religion, we can't target an ethnic
group. But apparently nobody in policy-making position. I get a couple hundred emails a day, too, and I get hate mail and I get death threats and all. I mean, that's just what happens when you do stuff in public. But are there any policymakers? Are there people in Congress? You say it's the liberals. You know, when you say, hey, we ought to be looking at potential terrorists, are there policymakers who are saying, no, you can't, that's not politically correct?
No, what I'm saying.
Can you name one?
No, even one? No, I can't.
In all of the United States?
Well, you know, I probably...
300 million people?
Yeah, no, okay, but fine. I'll come back to you with that, with a list. But what I'm saying is what I'm saying wrong?
Well, it might have been good to start with a list, because then you could have said what I'm saying is right, and here's the proof of it.
Well, regardless, the genesis, the point of the column is, you know, should we be, you know, examining some of these people? And it seems to me that the answer is yes. And, you know, and also when I wrote for townhall.com and I got a... you know, well over 100 different emails from people who took the time to write back. And, you know, none of them were nutcases. Many of them were, you know, between priests, rabbis, you know, what we would consider just, you know, everyday Americans. And they were all very thoughtful emails just saying, you know, I'm concerned about this, and I don't understand, you know, why we can't do something like that. I mean, I'm Scottish-American, and if 19 of the hijackers were Scottish-Americans, you know, would I want my background investigated? The answer is sure. And I think what I hear, Tom, over and over again from different viewers and readers is at least they feel that Muslim Americans in this country, including some of my friends, and I've had these discussions with them, at the very least aren't speaking up enough about this, you know, and saying, you know, let's condemn this, let's have a march, you know, against this type of violence in the United States. And that's, I think that's a legitimate concern for a lot of people.
That's a really good point, Doug McKinnon. We're talking with Doug McKinnon of townhall.com. And as a matter of fact, right after 9/11, Muslim Americans were out in the streets and were marching. I mean, there were, and not just Muslim Americans. We had, there were marches in downtown Tehran, Iran, in favor of the United States.
No, there were some, that's right. And but what I also quoted in the column, you know, was when you had the bombings in London, you know, a year ago, July, one of the moderate Muslim clerics, you know, went on, was interviewed by BBC or Sky over in London, and he condemned the bombings. But he condemned the bombings not because it took innocent life. And this, again, this is a quote-unquote moderate Muslim cleric in London. But what he said was, you know, to me it was a waste of time because in 20 or 30 years we're going to control this country anyway, so there's no sense in doing something like that. And it just seems to me that if someone says something like that, and if he's a moderate, you know, Muslim cleric, then other Muslims have an obligation to speak up and say, look, he doesn't represent my point of view. I want to condemn these bombings in the strongest possible way. And I also worry, you know, geez, is something like this going to happen in the United States? If Muslim Americans, you know, Islamists basically, do decide to attack New York or Washington again, and they killed a number of Muslims in New York, obviously 5 years ago today, would they kill a number of Muslim Americans in the next attack? I mean, it's a legitimate question. You know, no one's saying, you know, let's get the secret police out there and look into this. I'm just saying it seems to me to make common sense to look into this.
Well, first of all, I'm not disagreeing with you that it's a legitimate question. Secondly,
right.
I would say, yes, let's get the secret police out there and look into this. You know, with a warrant from a judge who has said, yes, there's actually some evidence that there's a crime being committed here. But you're talking about, you know, moderate Muslim clerics. We had moderate Christian clerics in the United States after 9/11 saying, we deserved this. We should get more of this. I mean, here, right here. It's
what
just
we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is,
well, I mean,
could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and
God
allow
9/11,
the enemies of America
to
give us probably what we deserve.
And then Pat Robertson agrees.
Well, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror.
I mean, you know, these are moderate Christian leaders. The question, Doug McKinnon with townhall.com, that really comes to mind for me is the majority of the terrorists and the majority of the terrorist attacks in the United States that we've experienced have been from white supremacists. They have, you know, including Tim McVeigh and the bombing of the Oklahoma City building. You've got the Turner Diaries, widely read. It's a book in which have you read the Turner Diaries, Doug?
I have not. No.
Okay.
Let me
recommend it to you. I mean, I don't mean that as like some kind of debate.
Oh no, sure.
I
understand.
You know, it's let me recommend it. It's a novel. In the novel, there's this guy who's a good patriotic white Anglo-Saxon American who realizes that what he refers to as the mud people, you know, people who are not white, very, very white of skin, ranging from in his mind, from Jews through Hispanics, through African Americans, through Asians, I mean, right across the line, that they are the real threat to America. And so, but he believes that the government is being taken over by them, and the only way to take back the government is for the white Anglo-Saxon gun owners to stand up and fight. And so, in the novel, the good guy blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City. The government responds by creating a concentration camp down somewhere in the South and putting people in that concentration camp without giving them access to a lawyer, without giving them due process of law, without giving them access to a judge and jury,
right.
You know, which is starting to sound eerily deja vu. As a result of this, the good white gun-owning Americans of America stand up and say, we're not going to take this anymore. We're going to fight a revolution, and a battle starts. I mean, a literal battle starts in the United States, And the end, and it's a, you know, quite a dramatic story. And in the end of the story, all the Jews have been killed, all the African Americans have been killed, all the Asian Americans have been killed,
right.
All the Latinos have been killed or driven out of the country, and most of the Catholics have been killed. And what's left are the good gun-owning white Anglo-Saxon Protestants standing over the rubble, sort of like in the Iwo Jima mission. And that was what Tim McVeigh had in his mind. And there are thousands of people in the United States who hold that same vision, who are very, very well armed, who have large camps, who have, you know, caches of explosives. And when they're discussed in the media, there's nothing close to the hysteria of six relatively illiterate, largely incoherent guys down in Florida who had to be supplied by the FBI with the wherewithal to even say on a hidden camera, death to America.
Right.
Doug, can you stick around over the break and we can just wrap this thing up?
Sure.
Because I'd like to get into that, how we deal with the difference. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
And welcome back.
Broken baby.
Past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Doug McKinnon. He is a writer for townhall.com, the conservative website first founded, as I recall, by William F. Buckley, Jr. The article, Homegrown Terrorists. Doug is also a top aide to former Senator Robert Dole and a former top White House and Pentagon aide. And Doug, welcome back to the program.
Tom, I appreciate it. And I just wanted to, without giving myself a plug, to go back to your point with white supremacists and gun
sure.
owners and that nature. I've got a new novel coming out called America's Lost Days, which deals very much with that subject. You'll be surprised to find out. And actually, it was blurred by James Carville and Dee Dee Myers, among others, because I think it's a fair interpretation of what's going on. But that's also a concern of mine. And again, that's why I sort of tackled that subject.
Well, I salute you for that. And the thing that mystifies me, Doug, and maybe you can provide some enlightenment for me on this, or perhaps we're even of the same mind of it on it. I'm not really sure. But we know that there are among us thousands, certainly thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, maybe even more than that, of people who are well-armed. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the Colt 45 here. People who are seriously well armed,
sure.
You know, the David Koresh's of the world, if you will, at his worst. I mean, I'm reluctant to even use that name because it means so many different things to different people.
Right.
You know who I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking
sure.
about. There are terrorists among us, and there have been literally since the founding of this country. Many of them used to be organized in groups like the White Citizens League and the Ku Klux Klan, who use the methods of terror against people in the United States, who've used it for political power, who've used it for financial gain. And frankly, I suspect that their numbers in this country exceed the numbers of the Muslims. The difference is that their skin is white and their ancestry is European. And in the mainstream media, and they've been very successful, by the way, at actually having terrorist events. I mean, you know, blowing up the building in Oklahoma City. We didn't declare a war on them. Clinton simply said, hey, this guy is crazy. Let's get the police. Let's track him down and put him in prison for the rest of his life or put him into death. And we did. And anybody associated with him, you know, Terry Nichols out there, he's in jail. And so why is it that people who have brown skin and a different religion from the mainstream in America evoke the kind of histrionics might be too strong a word, because I don't want to characterize what you're writing as histrionic. I take this seriously, but I don't think it's an inappropriate word, at least for a large segment of the American population. Why is it the people of brown skin and a different religion evoke this kind of fear and loathing, whereas a very real threat, not necessarily the real threat, but let's say another real threat, very real threat here within the United States, is by and large ignored?
Sure. Well, yeah, a couple of points. One is, you know, just for your listeners' edification, you know, more often than not, with regard to my columns, which I'll also run in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and L.A. Times, and others, I take on the Republican Party probably more than Democrats. One of the subjects that has incensed me the last number of years is the support for assault weapons, and I've gone after that a number of times and been criticized quite strongly within my own party for going after that. I think it's a disgrace. So I'm with you on that one. And with regard to why it's an easy target, why we go after Muslims or people with a different skin color, I think most of it, Tom, just boils down to human nature, too. You know, if it's different from us, then we tend to, you know, be suspicious of it. We don't understand it. We don't try to understand it.
Sure, there's that feeling of, this is our family, that's another family. This is our tribe, that's another tribe.
Well, and, you know, and for me, ignorance is one of the most dangerous things in the world, and ignorance is also a tremendous tool for terrorists, whether they, again, are white supremacists, you know, Islamists that might try to take over the country. It's incumbent upon us, I believe, to try to learn as much about these groups as possible. And just, one minor point with regard to what President Clinton was doing after, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm not a defender of the Clinton administration per se, although I know the president a little bit. But I do know some of the FBI agents that were working on that, and they were working pretty hard behind the scenes to go after groups like that. They just weren't publicizing it and releasing it to the mainstream media. So, clearly...
But there weren't the big, you know, John Ashcroft-type announcements, you know, going on like
no,
going
there
on
weren't.
Bush.
But also, you know, that goes to the point, you know, Republicans are always easy to criticize the mainstream media as, you know, being left of center and you know, carrying water for liberals. But also, you know, the mainstream media has an obligation to go after, you know, sort of the white supremacists and the skinheads and some
but
of the...
But they don't.
But they don't. That's exactly right. And Tom, you know as well as I do that is sort of if it bleeds, it leads. You know, they look at what spikes a rating, whether it's on the cables especially. If it's JonBenet, if it's Tom Cruise, it's going to spike the ratings, and that's what they're going to do until the rating goes back down.
Yeah.
And
so
it's not a sexy story for them, but it's irresponsible for them not to cover that subject as well.
Yeah, I agree. So we're back to the problem of the media. Doug McKinnon, he's writing over at townhall.com, this particular piece, the article, Homegrown Terrorists. Doug, thanks for being with us this morning.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good speaking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Have you forgotten?
6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where's Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned, Mr. President.
Gosh, I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
And, you know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
You know, they don't want to forget the feeling of horror, but they want to forget that the...
The West has dropped the ball. Bin Laden is still a free man.
And you say we shouldn't worry about Bin Laden. And we vowed to get Bin Laden. Have you forgotten?
Well, I think that it's much broader than any one person. This is a war on terrorism. It's broader than any one person. It's a struggle of ideology.
That's like saying somebody got murdered and the police can't catch him. And when they ask the police, hey, well, why, how come you haven't caught the murderer? They say, well, it's not about that murder. It's about the war on crime.
The audio tape from Osama bin Laden also makes an offer of a truce with the U.S. Tell us about that.
We do not negotiate with terrorists. We put them out of business.
Apparently not.
Have you forgotten?
Oh, man.
All the people killed. Yes, some went down like he.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Special thanks to Peter B. Collins, my good friend from San Francisco, who filled in for us on Thursday and Friday from Camp Democracy in Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. version of Camp Casey. And thanks so much, Peter, for a job well done. And you got a lot of good listener feedback, and Peter's a great guy, and I really appreciate his doing that for me. He was doing it so that I could be in New York. I was, C-SPAN, in fact, showed up and did a hour and a half video of me about the new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It, which I think is one of the best books I've ever written. And it's out in stores now. We did a book signing over at Vox Pop on Saturday and had a whole bunch of gigs throughout the week, different media gigs. And the C-SPAN thing will be, I don't know when it's going to be aired. As soon as we find out, we'll announce it so that you can learn about it. But what was interesting was at the Vox Pop thing, you know, I mentioned on this program I was going to be there, and it was standing room only. I mean, the place was so packed, there were people spilling out onto the streets. It was so hot in there from all the bodies that halfway through I was just covered with sweat. It's gonna look terrible on television, I'm telling you. I look like some guy working in the fields or something. Well, I was, in a way, metaphorically speaking. I was frankly surprised by virtually everybody who was there was a regular listener to the program, and so thank you for showing up, to those of you who are listeners to the program. And there were a number of people who were listeners to Sirius. I was surprised by that. I'd say probably 20% of the people who were there. You think of Sirius Satellite Radio as just kind of having a wide but thin national reach. They have a very strong reach in the New York metro area. People came from as far as 200 miles away for that book signing. So that was really nice. A number of people asked me, you know, how do we get more than just 1 hour on Sirius? I'd say, you know, talk to the folks at Sirius about it. It's not my decision, it's theirs. And but I want to thank you. Thank you so much for showing up. It was a great time. I had a great time in New York City. I'll be in San Francisco this coming weekend. We'll be doing some more book events. Feel free to drop in and say hi. All the information is over at our website, tomhartmann.com. Just click on contacts, and the book schedule's down toward the bottom of the page, but it's all right there. 38 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartmann.com. That'll get you there. Larry in LaSalle, Indiana on the line. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for the things you do, Tom. You know, I was kind of hoping to ask that guy some questions. You know, fascism needs all these hate groups. I hate to keep buying into these people. And you know, what I'd really like to do is follow the money. You know, it's an untold amount of money, Middle East money that our policymakers match or manage in this country. And that, you know, the thing of it is, the war against their side of it needs massive amounts of money, and I have yet to hear anybody say where all that money comes from, you know.
Yeah, well, there's some words to that. There's some interesting information about it, Larry, at least with this new $40 million donation to the Republican National Committee that was given by ABC yesterday and today. And this is fascinating. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Over at Pensito Review, one of the better blogs posted by John Potter, it's called Ponder. It's called The Path to Scafe. And the question is, who paid for ABC's $40 million docudrama? Max Blumenthal's expose over at the Huffington Post on the right-wing cabal behind ABC's miniseries, The Path to 9/11, is a must-read. He says, according to Blumenthal, the show's producer, director, and writer are part of a conservative insurgency within Hollywood, connections to David Horowitz. And then they go through this. However, the connection to the conservative power grid that may be the most interesting, however, is the production's ties to Richard Mellon Scaife. They say since the inauguration of Bill Clinton in 1992, Horowitz, by the way, has been a guest on this program twice, has labored to create a network of politically active conservatives in Hollywood. His Hollywood nest centers around his Wednesday Morning Club, a weekly meet-and-greet session for Left Coast conservatives who have been graced with speeches by the likes of Newt Gingrich, Victor Davis Hanson, and Christopher Hitchens. Group's headquarters are at the offices of Horowitz's Center for the Study of Popular Culture, a think tank bankrolled for years with millions by right-wing sugar daddies like eccentric far-right billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife. Scaife also financed the Arkansas Project, a $2.3 million dirty trick operation that including paying sources for negative stories about Bill Clinton that turned out to be false. So you want to follow the money? There's a place to start. There's a place to start. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. Hey, Rama, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Listening to your guest at the beginning of the hour is one of the things I know makes me feel really uncomfortable when people give this, well, it was all Muslims who attacked us on September 11th, so we have to be really vigilant with Muslims. is it goes to the basis of how they're trying to describe things. And I think this is where they make an innocent shortcoming, in that everybody who attacked us on September 11th also breathed through their lungs, had a nose, two eyes, a head, two arms, two legs, etc. But we don't go out and say, well, now we've got to check everybody who breathes through their lungs and has two eyes and nose, two...
Well, here's a point of concurrence, or a point of, what would the word be, consistency, similarness to us, that's even greater than the purely biological ones, at least for the purposes of this discussion that you're talking about, Rama. And that is that the people, assuming that the story of the 9/11 Commission has at least some large germ of truth to it, that there really were 14 folks from Saudi Arabia and five other guys who flew these planes into the towers, the Pentagon, and into the field in Pennsylvania. The thing that's the common thread between them, assuming that the conspiracy theory put together by the 9/11 Commission is correct, is that they were all fundamentalists. They were all religious fundamentalists. And so if we really want to be concerned, and that was the point that I was trying to make to our guest, was that we have a homegrown, very toxic, and with deep historic roots, religious fundamentalist terrorist infrastructure here in the United States, about which it is almost never mentioned. For example, when this guy in Texas was found with the largest collection of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a private individual in the history of the United States, it was only reported in the Texas newspapers. Now, if a Muslim in New Jersey was found with one-fifth that amount of stuff, you'd have ABC and NBC hyperventilating for 2 days. You'd have Rita Cosby talking about it so fast she'd pass out. Her lips would turn purple.
Well, here's
not
where,
that they aren't already.
Here's where I think even you may be missing it from my perspective, Tom, is that the religious fundamentalist part doesn't really bother me so much. I my daughter went to a fundamentalist Baptist school for several years, and I wasn't afraid of that. I am not a Christian by any definition. Well, I guess by generic definition, maybe. But I have some neighbors who I respect and I trust and I like a lot, who are fundamentalist Baptists. So it's not the religious fundamentalism part. It's a more basic value, and it's people of violence that we have to be leery of.
So we need a new term to define that, because Rama, I mean, there was a time in my life when I was attending the North Lansing Church of God, which is about as fundamentalist as you can get, and you know, I was into that thing, you know, becoming a born again Christian, and nobody there was talking about let's blow up a building.
Right.
And yet there is an element within Christianity that is very much about blowing up buildings.
Yep.
And we lack a word for it then.
It's Tom, it's people of violence, and they don't want to put it in those terms, because if you start talking about people of violence, all of a sudden you're not just talking about Osama bin Laden, you're also talking about quite literally George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and a whole host of others.
Well, and these are people who have killed in the name of their religion.
Exactly, and that's
what the world is so upset about.
And that's what we need to, that's what we should be guarding against. People of violence, rapists and murderers and burglars and people that declare wars for lies, etc. It's peoples of violence. And I think this is where all of this, you know, even where you say the religious fundamentalist part, it starts to fall down, because just because somebody is a Muslim or a fundamentalist or black or white doesn't mean they're a person of violence, somebody you have to be afraid of. It's when it's people of violence, and that's what we really need to watch for.
Yeah, and that's what's being taught in the Wahhabist schools. That's what's being exported from Saudi Arabia, by and large, probably more than any other place in the United States, and it's being paid for by our gasoline money. If you shop anywhere except Citgo, if you buy your gasoline anywhere at Citgo.
And Tom,
it's
being taught by one other group that we should be leery of, by our government.
How so?
Well, they keep telling us war's the answer, wars.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Very, very good point, Rama. Yeah, in fact...
when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
45 minutes past the hour.
Yo.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and threw them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. I'm taking my country back.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Alice in Inverness, Florida, asking, what's bad about Citgo? Nothing. My point was, Citgo is owned by the Venezuelan oil company, and so if you're buying your oil or gasoline from Citgo, you're supporting medical services and housing and food for poor people in South and Central America and in Boston. Whereas if you're buying it from any other oil company, you're supporting fat cats like Fat Bastard, also known as Lee Raymond, and the Saudi royal family. That was the bottom line on that. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Annette in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Annette, we're in day two of the ABC mockumentary the giant PR blitz for the Republican Party. I don't know what to call this thing.
I know. I don't know how many people have heard about this, but I think I saw it on Keith Olbermann. The only thing they're changing, when they say they're changing things, is actually things to do with the credits.
I watched the first 10 minutes of it last night because it was on after my bedtime. I mean, you know, it came on at 8 o'clock.
I couldn't even stand to watch it.
And I'm asleep at 7 because I have to get up at 3 to do this, to do my morning program. But I stayed up and I watched the first 10 minutes. And right in the promo, I mean, right in the opening credits, as they, you know, the stuff that they were rolling the credits over, was the scene where the guy was saying to Sandy Berger, what? You're not going to allow us to take out Bin Laden?
Or words to that effect.
And I was like, oh, well, you know, this is probably one of the most egregious scenes in the whole thing, because nothing did not happen, but they made it up out of whole cloth, and it's one of the major Republican talking points that's a lie!
Right. Doesn't that kill you? That's what they led off with.
Oh, yeah.
They were going to make changes. But anyway, I thought it was interesting to hear that the only changes that they made were some minor changes in the credits and things in that area so that they could say they made changes.
Yeah. Well, you just have to wonder.
No surprise.
I gotta say, the mouse is dead to me.
Right.
I mean, I will never again ever take my children, grandchildren, anybody related to my family to Disney World. I ABC for all practical purposes no longer exists on my television.
Right.
I've notified my local affiliate of that.
Yep.
And I am going to start digging to find out. ABC is one of these big, giant, mergered companies. I'm going to find out what other products are made by ABC or ABC affiliates.
Good idea.
And from this point forward, I'm going to boycott them. And I am a person who is generally opposed to boycotts. But I am beyond sickened, beyond disgusted.
Well, they managed to get Reagan, that story about Reagan, off there.
Oh, I know. That didn't even have errors of fact. That just had, you know, it pointed out that one of his sons was adopted, the one that they're trying to turn into a right-wing talk host.
Exactly.
And that Ronald Reagan was a real person, not just, you know, king of the world. And, they had no disputes about items of fact with regard to that. In fact, when it replayed on whatever it was, USA Network or something, it played intact. Yeah.
Right.
So. Amazing.
Well, how about Fahrenheit 9-1-1?
Miramax, which is owned by Disney, dropped that at the last minute and refused to promote that. Bill Maher's program was syndicated on ABC, and after 9/11 they dropped it. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm sorry, the mouse is dead. And this is from a guy who I don't boycott Walmart, you know, because like I said, I think the rules of the game need to be changed. And this is certainly illustrates the fact that the rules of the game, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, that Bill Clinton, I was going to make a reference to the afterlife. I don't think I will, because Bill Clinton will a lot of decent things. But nonetheless, if that is something that was an absolute betrayal of the citizens of the United States and of democracy itself, is signing the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
Oh, you're telling me. How could he have done that?
He could have done that because a lot of palms were greased. Trust me.
And
that and Reagan suspending the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982 and doing away with the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. And that's what all led to this. And I'm sorry,
well, and,
the mouse is dead.
And NAFTA.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I look at Clinton and I think, what in the heck is going on?
Yeah, like I said, Bill Clinton did a lot of good things, but there's two areas, the free trade agreements and the Telecommunications Act, where he sold us out.
Well, he did.
They're absolutely huge. I got to move along, Annette. Thank you very much for the call.
Thanks for your time.
Yep, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes, welcome back, Tom.
Thank you.
Nice to be back here. I was listening to the interview you had with the gentleman in the early part of the hour, and I actually, from what I heard, I can kind of agree with a lot of what you both were saying. I do think that we on the left do tend to be a little too politically correct, a little too guilty about the fact that a lot of us are Christians and a lot of us are whites, and forget that there's people in the world that hate us because we are Christian and because we're white. Now, can I just give two examples of where the United States helped Muslims? They helped Kuwait get under the enslavement of, or at least the invasion of Saddam Hussein, and we helped the Bosnians, many of whom were Muslims, who were being murdered by Croats and
by Christians.
Kurds.
Yeah.
And so I think these folks have a short memory. And then Bin Laden says, well, we've got to get these infidels off of our soil in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, we haven't done a good job of promoting it, you know, frankly. But the other thing that I think is really interesting, and Rick, thank you for the call, is that while there have been essentially Muslim insurgencies in a number of other countries, we've seen it in France, we've seen it in England, we've seen it in Spain, not so much so here. And I think that that's a testimonial to the melting pot of America, to the fact that to the extent that we can calm down the rhetoric coming out of the Republican National Committee and coming out of places like this town hall publication, to the extent that we can calm down this histrionic, fundamentally racist undercurrent rhetoric, I think most Muslims in the United States have very well integrated, thank you very much. I mean, let's keep in mind, you know, Ralph Nader, actually, I don't know his religion, he's Lebanese. I mean, you know, you've got, there are a lot of good Muslims in the United States. Again, I should take Ralph out of that because I don't know his religion, but there are a lot of good, it's just, the United States is a place where you can come and be yourself. And that's something that I think even Muslims acknowledge. 57 minutes past the hour. This is Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu said, Mozambique's enemy combatant, title of a book, is a serious indictment of the U.S. for eroding the rule of law by disregarding habeas corpus, as did the apartheid regime in South Africa. Here we have Desmond Tutu comparing the United States to South Africa. Mozambique is with us on the line. Sir, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to say you are the first detainee at Guantanamo Bay I have ever spoken with. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Your background, I found this fascinating. A second-generation British citizen raised by a banker father in Birmingham, England. You attended a Jewish day school as a child, turned increasingly to your Muslim faith in your early 20s, opened a Muslim bookstore in your hometown, traveled to Bosnia and again to the Middle East to aid in relief efforts and do charitable work in war-torn Afghanistan. How then did you end up in Guantanamo Bay and Bagram?
Oh, my goodness, that's a whole story in itself. But the short of it is that in 2001, I and my family, my wife and children, had decided to move to Afghanistan for a short-term project that we'd begun in the United Kingdom, which was to build a school for girls in an area where the Taliban didn't allow female education, and also to build wells in some of the drought-stricken regions of the northwest, which is what we did in June of 2001.
So in regard to building a school for girls, you were doing exactly the opposite of what Bin Laden would have approved of.
I don't know whether it's so much Bin Laden as the Taliban. Certainly the Taliban were the ones who had said that there was no women's education around, allowed at the time, which I right. think that was the case in relation to a lot of the non-Muslim organizations who were trying to do that job.
But isn't that also considered consistent with Wahhabism?
No, I don't think so, because in Saudi Arabia is a Wahhabi state, and there you've got universities for women and schools and colleges. So I think that's not correct.
Okay, I stand corrected. Thank you for helping to educate me here. So you were telling your story.
So I think that as what happened is that eventually when the September 11th attacks did take place, I evacuated eventually after when the United States of America bombed, and me, my family and I had to evacuate to Pakistan, where I have dual nationality and family and relatives. So we stayed there for a couple of months helping other refugees, and during that time, on the 31st of January 2002, was when I received a knock at my door at midnight and was faced with several people pointing guns at me, and electric stun guns too, who shackled me, pushed me to the ground, put a hood over my head, and dragged me into the back of a 4x4 and carried me away.
Were you told what the charges were against you?
No, charges and arrest and that sort of terminology didn't really exist. It was a pure kidnap. One of the things that I did see was an American, quite obviously, which I recognized from his accent, when he produced a pair of handcuffs and said that this is from the wives of one of the victims of September 11th for me, given to me in order for me to catch the culprits. And then he proceeded to put them on me, as if to say that I was somehow responsible for that. But I mean, it was Kafkaesque, but very frightening, because I couldn't have believed that this was the beginning of a three-year ordeal, which was going to be the greatest test of my life.
Yeah, by Kafkaesque, I assume you're referring to his short story, The Prisoner?
Absolutely. It's, you know, to being in a situation where you just don't believe what's happening to you can happen, and yet exactly that is the reality of your manifest
yeah,
situation.
I would recommend all of our listeners read that short story by Franz Kafka. In The Prisoner, however, as I recall, it's been 25, 30 years since I read it, but my recollection is that the prisoner eventually breaks down and begins turning in those around him. What was your experience?
Well, yeah, that did happen to me on occasion. Of course, it was after several years in Guantanamo and elsewhere, where you feel that you're beginning to lose the fight against desperation and hopelessness. I certainly had several anxiety attacks in which I punched the walls and kicked them and screamed and cried, because I didn't know when, if I was going to be released from there, if I was ever going to see my family again, what the charges against were me, what is it that I had done so badly to the United States in which caused them to treat me in this way, how had I harmed them for them to harm me in this way. I didn't understand. And that was probably the hardest thing to face, other than the intermittent or sporadic bouts of physical abuse that I had to face.
Now, according to George W. Bush, just last week, he said, "We do not torture prisoners." Does your experience? We're talking with Mozem Beg, who is the author of a new book, "Enemy Combatant: My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar." An actual detainee or whatever in our various concentration camps, who has now been released and is speaking out and has written a brilliant, brilliant book, which you must buy, Enemy Combatant by Mozem Beg. Was your experience consistent with George Bush's statement this week or last week that the United States does not participate in or condone the torture of the people who have been arrested in our name?
Well, there are two aspects to this. The first one, I will tell you that when I was held in Bagram, I was told by the CIA that another man had been seated just where I was only a few weeks earlier. Now, this man was said to be a high-ranking al-Qaeda catch, who they then sent to Egypt to be tortured under the auspices of the CIA, and they extracted a confession from him saying that he was working, his organization was working to obtain weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein. Now, that was used as an evidence to enter Iraq and to begin the war there. It's of course found to be that it was said on under torture, under duress, and it caused the deaths and destruction of the whole of the people of Iraq and indeed many U.S. soldiers. But the second point to this is that President Bush may in fact believe that he doesn't condone the use of torture. All that he does do is to redefine its terminology. So that we hear about waterboarding, we hear about people being left naked, people being kicked or punched, or perhaps having your arm twisted but not really ha- having it taken out of its socket. Those sorts of things are the reinterpretations of torture. And of course, if he says, yeah, well, the real what we mean by torture is pulling out fingernails and electrocutions and things like that. Yeah, we don't do that, but we'll do the other things. I think that there's a deliberate attempt to redefine its meaning.
Was that, sir, the experience that you had or that you saw around you or both?
I think in the worst cases, the worst instances that I saw, particularly in one that's been widely reported in the United States, is the death of a man called Mr. Dilawa. And he was in my cell, tied with his hands above his head and a hood placed over it. They administered to him what they call a peroneal strike, which is a strike, a sort of a Thai boxing style strike to the thigh. He had 100 strikes delivered to him on his thigh, which caused his blood to stop flowing properly and caused his death, which was proved to me by U.S. interrogators, internal interrogators, who a year and a half later showed me the pictures of his body and asked me to identify the soldiers that I feel were responsible. So it was part of a system that had trickled down, in which Donald Rumsfeld had said that I stand in my duty for 8 hours a day. Why can't these detainees stand for much more? Which obviously was alluding to putting detainees in stress positions and forcing them to stand, which he didn't mention, of course, was that they were hooded and shackled at the same time when they were standing.
Yeah, yeah. And it was much more than 8 hours, and he's walking around. The parallels are, it's insane to draw such parallels. We're talking with Mohsen Beg. He's the author of a new book, Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. I'm going to get the real story of the concentration camps that the United States is running around the world by this book. This is amazing. One of the complaints that has been made, in fact, the Solicitor General of the Army last week, the lead legal officer of the Army, made the point that extracting information from people by violence or by threats of violence will more often than not produce information that's of little value, and under our legal system, at least to the point that it hasn't been totally devastated by Mr. Bush, although he's making some new efforts at that, very rarely produces honest, truthful, useful information. Whereas the classic techniques that were used, for example, during World War II, by the U.S. and by other allied forces with the Germans, the Japanese, and their allies, of basically trying to induce the Stockholm syndrome, getting the person who has been taken captive to identify with their captors and thus spill the beans, is actually a fairly successful way to derive information from people. Is your experience consistent with that?
I think so. I think absolutely. I think that you treat people in a particular way. You treat them as you would wish to be treated, as many of the soldiers quoted as a mantra, although not necessarily as a practice. So I think that's certainly ineffective. I've already quoted to you what happened to this man, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi.
Yeah, if you could stick around and just tell us that story after this break. Are you available? Great.
Yes.
We're talking with Mohsen Beg. His new book is Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. I'm Tom Hartman, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds
that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America, from north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for real people who can't ignore that we shall reap.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. We're talking with Mohsen Beg. He's the author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. And thank you for staying over with us. We have probably another 5 minutes here that we can talk. And you were starting to respond to my question of, which in short form is, You know, what's the best way to interrogate somebody and get useful information?
Yes, I was saying that the second part of what I said was that it had already transpired that this person who had taken to Bagram and tortured, and it was his confession was used as a means to justify the war in Iraq, is an evident proof of how not to do it. I think the way to do it is to treat people in the way that they would want to be treated, the way that you would want to be treated, and of course according to the conventions that already exist in the treatment of prisoners, not only in the United States of America, but also in what's termed to be wars around the world. This is, we're told that this is a new situation, but people are not new. The people are the same, and the human beings are still the same, and they still need to be treated in the same way.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is we extracted over several hundred year period in Europe and in particularly in the state of Massachusetts in North America, we extracted the confessions of well over a million women that they were witches and put them to death. Doesn't mean that any of it was true.
Indeed, I think that it's a very, very dangerous road to go down, and there's that argument about the ticking time bomb and so forth, and perhaps under some circumstances it's possible to save loads and, you know, millions of lives, but that doesn't seem to happen. It doesn't seem that that's ever happened historically, that people have succumbed to this sort of treatment and then spilled all the beans, as it were. It means then also that we've become the society that we claimed we would never become.
Mozambique, with regard to the author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar, what's your sense of the future for the entire world, including the United States, but for the entire world, with regard to this whole situation of terrorism, both as a tactic and increasingly as being identified as an enemy, certainly by Bush and company?
I think there's an important thing here to look at. Today, of course, is the anniversary of the terrible attacks of September the 11th. Those people shouldn't have died. It shouldn't have happened, and yet it did. But at least we know how many people died. We know to the number almost. It was 2,700 and however many who died. There's no such similar figure or estimate about the people who died in Iraq as a result, or even Afghanistan as a result. And what it's saying to the rest of the world is that we're not really counting those people because, for all intents and purposes, their lives don't count. And this is the message.
The people that we bombed, you mean?
Yes, absolutely. The people that have been killed on the other side by U.S. bombs. Mm. So I think that once we go down this road and tell people that their lives are worth nothing, then the world can only become a less safe place. And that, in fact, is what's happened. There needs to be a lot more dialogue. There needs to be a lot more understanding. And that can only come about through education, not through bombing and not through fighting and not through war-type rhetoric.
There was an interesting analysis done. There's a book about it. The title and author are escaping me. It's been some time. That suggested that terrorism, first of all, is not the province of the religious. The Tamil Tigers, for example, in Sri Lanka are among the, I think they're responsible for over 70 of the roughly 300 terrorist attacks around the world over the last few years.
Including suicide bombings, yes, that's right.
That's right. And specifically suicide-based attacks. And yet they are openly anti-religious. And so it's number one, it's not the sole province of the religious. The myth of, oh, I'm doing this to get 77 virgins is a fantasy. That this is really the last tactic in a series of tactics which are used by people who are trying to protect their homeland, protect their families, or in their own mind anyway. This is their perception.
I think that that's what certainly spurned it. I mean, you know, perhaps September 11th may, you know, in the Western world, it's seen as this attack that's come from nowhere. But in the Eastern world, it doesn't. It's not like that. People talk about how thousands of children died as a result just from the medical sanctions alone in Iraq, as opposed to the tens of thousands who died in the first set of bombings in the first Gulf War. And then if you take just Operation Restore Hope, an incongruously named American operation again, 1,000 Somalis died in the day of that Black Hawk Down incident. And all we remember are the 19 Americans, which of course is a tragedy. But that means that, we're not reciprocating our sentiments, and that is what's creating a great disdain and a great vacuum, which has been left, of course, after the Soviet Union, which is being filled in by what are regarded as terrorist types or militants.
Yeah, and they're taking the poverty and the desperation of people and exploiting it in many cases for their own benefit, rich enrichment power, as it may be. Mozambique, the title, his last name, B-E-G-G, if you're Googling this thing, the title is Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. Sir, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for listening.
It's been an honor speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I dream of a world where, though we're not the same, freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world. I dream of a world. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
Ah, yes, the good old days. When we get both sides of the story, or maybe even three or four sides to the story, because every story doesn't have... In fact, it's very rare, frankly, that there's a story with only two sides. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be with you once again. I think it's time for us to have an activism alert here.
May take all we down and may take long out. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yes, step by step, we're taking back this country and its marvelous natural resources. This from the Audubon Society, audubon.org. Teshekpuk Lake in northern Alaska, it's pronounced T-E-S-H-E-K-P-U-K. Teshekpuk Lake, the ecological jewel of Alaska, is now being offered to big oil. Teshekpuk Lake in northern Alaska is a fragile wilderness that is home to an incredibly diverse variety of migratory shorebirds, waterfowl, and wildlife. This vast network of wetlands surrounding Teshekpuk Lake has been recognized since 1977 by Congress and three prior Interior Secretaries for its importance to wildlife and the Inupiat natives. Yet in January 2006, the Bush administration removed the longstanding protection for the Teshekpuk Lake wetlands, a federally designated special area on the north slope of Alaska. This remote area has deep water lakes that offer high quality forage and refuge for flightless geese to escape predators. These attributes attract up to 37,000 Pacific black brant and 35,000 greater white fronted geese, as well as thousands of Canada and snow geese for their annual molt. I wonder if when they stop at my house, we live in a floating house on the Willamette River. I wonder if and the Canadian geese are stopping there all the time and pooping all over my back deck, and well, we feed them, you know, corn chips and whatnot. But anyway, I wonder if they're coming from Canada as they're traveling through. In addition, the 45,000 head Teshekpuk Lake caribou herd returns to this habitat every year to bear its calves. Inupiat natives who have lived in this region for thousands of years, and my apologies if I'm mispronouncing any of this, depend on the caribou to support their subsistence culture. You can help protect this fragile wilderness by telling Secretary of the Interior Dirk Kempthorne to cancel the oil lease sale scheduled for September. Any day now, they're going to sell this thing off. They're going to sell it to the oil companies. Drilling in this lake region is not going to solve our energy problems. It's just going to make a couple billion dollars for the donors to the Republican Party. Call Dirk Kempthorne. He's the Secretary of Interior. His telephone number is area code 202-208-3100. I'll give that number again in just a minute. If we fail to halt this short-sighted action, writes the Audubon Society at audubon.org, critical wildlife habitat will be surrounded by roads, pipelines, airstrips, gravel mines, and industrial sprawl. Drilling at the Teshekpuk Lake Wilderness will not solve our energy problems. However, it will forever compromise the unique ecological and cultural importance of one of Alaska's most vital regions. It's spelled T-E-S-H-E-P-U-K, Lake. Teshekpuk? Maybe it is Teshekpuk Lake. And David, we should have done a find out how to pronounce this thing before we do it. Yeah, we will next time. Anyhow, here's Dirk Kempthorne's phone number, 202-208-3100. 202-208-3100. Give him a call and give him help. Our patriotic activism alert for the day. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for covering Mozambique story today. It was really stirring.
Yeah. Startling. Frightening. His book is amazing.
I just wanted to start off a little bit by telling my story. I got involved in politics, actually, because of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just shook me to my core and made me want to do something good for society. And so ever since then, I've been researching, trying to find out what happened that day, you know, why the Bush administration didn't want a commission and all that. And so 5 years later, to have take advantage of this opportunity to do a partisan fiction, it's like, why couldn't they show the best documentary out right now? Why couldn't they, you know, do their own investigation? Why did they have to go that direction? It just blows my mind.
Yeah, well, as I've been saying for some time now, we no longer have news in the United States. We have infotainment. And this is the ultimate infotainment. It's infotainment gussied up as news that isn't even true. I mean,
well,
it's not like the regular news, which is biased, you know, selectively omits things that are important and highlights things that are unimportant. This is actually falsehoods.
Well, I just wanted to tell people, if they've seen any part of it or if they're concerned about it, if they want to know what's really going on, there is a new documentary out that's touring the country right now. You can check it out on Google Video. It's called 9/11 Press for Truth, and
right.
It's about the history of the Center for Cooperative Research started by Paul Thompson,
yeah.
All about how they compiled from mainstream sources what really happened before, during, and after 9/11.
And the core of this, as I understand, is the 9/11 families themselves?
I'm not sure who. I know the Jersey Girls are advertising for it. I've got one of their banners on my blog, the Tahoma Activist. So
mm-hmm.
I know they have been really pushing for something good to come out. And this, I watched the trailer. I watched the first 5 minutes, and it was like my heart just fell to the floor. You know, finally something that actually explains what the mistakes were, you know.
Yeah. I'm going to have to track this thing down. I was in New York over the weekend. I spoke at there was a church in New York, the Metro Church down on off 9th Avenue, where they had a World Can't Wait Drive Out the Bush Regime meeting, worldcantwait.org, worldcantwait.net. And Mark Crispin Miller and I and a number of other people spoke there. And it was amazing. I mean, the church was absolutely packed. It was packed to the rafters. You couldn't even walk. I mean, it was amazing. And some very, very passionate people. And on October 5th is going to be a day of national mobilization for this. And one of the people there gave me the DVD that you're talking about.
Oh,
and,
Press for Truth?
Yeah, Press for Truth.
Cool.
And it looks really fascinating, really good, and really professional. And I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to catch my 6 a.m. flight out of JFK. And in the general madness, I left it behind in my hotel room in Manhattan. So,
pick it up online. It's also coming to Portland soon.
Yeah,
so
good.
You can see it live.
Good. Well, I'll see it. I'm looking for another copy of it because I'm
have
still,
you,
still kidding.
Have you ever interviewed Paul Thompson?
Not that I remember. I interview a lot of folks. Is he the guy behind it?
He's got a book called The Terror Timeline based on the Center for Cooperative Research website.
I'll check it out. Jeff, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Terry in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You know something? I think basically what we've got here is a constitutional democracy that has now got this fascist-leaning, militaristic dictatorship put in place. It's really frightening, but as far as the ABC movie, that Crocumentary or whatever they want to call it.
Oh, that's a good one. I've been calling it a mockudrama, but Crocumadrama is even better.
Well, I think, you know, at the end of it, they should have had George Bush saying, you know, I'm George Bush and I approve this message. It was sheer propaganda.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. I couldn't, actually, I didn't, I had to walk away a bunch of times.
Yeah, but it's the first half of it aired last night, and the second half is airing tonight. Is that right?
Yeah, the second half, I think, I've heard, is supposed to be more critical of Bush, but we'll see.
And apparently the second half, the part of it that's critical is, just by coincidence, the time when he's asking all the networks to drop their programming, preempt it so that he can give a speech?
Absolutely. This is propaganda that Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, would have been proud of. I would urge all of your listeners to take the time and write a letter to the editor about what the reality of this this path to 9/11, because that's the biggest problem. Is you're going to have all kinds of hayseeds and people that don't bother reading anything or believing that this is true, and that's the danger of it.
Yeah,
so
no, I agree, and you know, each one of us in our own small ways. I mean, my local station here in Portland, Oregon, Channel 2 is the local ABC affiliate. It doesn't exist on my TV any longer.
Yeah.
If there's some way that I can take it off the cable system, I will do it.
Well, you know, I just got off the phone with my broker not too long ago. And I'll tell you something. We were talking about this this path to 9/11 and the fact that ABC Disney is going to be looking at some probably some big fat lawsuits. They chose to tell a lie. And you've got people like you and me and a lot of other angry Americans who do know the truth that are going to be boycotting. And my broker had a feeling that this stock's going to tank a little bit. So I chose a put option for today, so I'll keep my eye on it. But anyone
well,
who's holding Disney
See,
stock,
you're betting the stock's going to fall.
Yeah, put option. I'm betting the stock's going to drop.
Yeah. How long does it puts last for what, 30, 60, 90 days? How long does
well,
before they expire?
It depends.
You can buy different kinds?
You can buy different types of options. But
You can tell I'm not a sophisticated investor.
But I'll tell you something. I think more Americans than not know what this is. And especially people that, you know, do own stock and things like that are going to be they're going to be watching this. And so anyone who's holding Disney stock, keep an eye on that, because it could be taking a
It could be taking a tank.
Now.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot, bye-bye. Terry. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by our listeners, by supporting our sponsors. This program brought to you today by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com. I got to tell you, I am not making this up. It is the best coffee I have ever had. Well, there was this one coffee shop in Western Germany that had some... but it's just as good. It really, in the United States, certainly the best coffee I've ever had. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website, and their toll-free number, 1-800-425-2532. 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now at 1-800-511-MAX or smalldog.com. 1-800-511-MACS for all things iPod, all things Macintosh. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Fred in Santa Clara, Oregon. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today?
Hello. This is my first call. What I'm calling
Welcome
about
to
was
the program.
I can't find any overnight ratings for that sloppy-metry that was showing last night.
They're actually showing up right now over at the Drudge Report, for what it's worth. And here, I'll just read it right straight off. It says, football ratings double ABC's 9/11 fuss film. 15.1 rating share for NBC's Sunday Night Football, 15.1 rating with a 23 share. And whereas the Path to 9/11 got an 8.3 rating with a 12 share, and CBS's 9/11 documentary got an 8.2 rating with a 12 share.
Very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. I knew that football game was going to draw more people.
Yeah. And Katie Couric, by the way, appears to be falling off the edge of the earth. Her ratings last week went from a 9.1 to on Monday to a 7.0, or Tuesday, I guess it was, to a 7.0, Wednesday to a 6.5, Thursday
right.
to a 4.9
right.
Friday. She's sinking.
And tonight, ABC
this kind of also according to Drudge,
because tonight is Monday Night Football, and ESPN, which is owned by ABC, by the way, has a doubleheader.
Yeah, well, and it's not only that, it's Bush is asking all the networks to preempt their programming, and how are they going to handle this? What are they going to do? How's it going to be? By the way, I just checked, the last caller was talking about selling her Disney stock. I just checked Disney's stock here at the New York Times on their they've got a page where you can look at any stock. And it's interesting to look. In July, their stock was as low as $24.95 a share. Right now, it's at $25.45. It's at a peak. In fact, it's at the peak over the last 3 months. I had to rechart it for a couple of years and see what it looks like. But apparently, a lot of investors are betting that ABC is doing something that's going to benefit them. And again, corporations are not altruists. They do things because it benefits them. And,
right.
and I think that ABC, by sucking up to the Bush administration as aggressively as they are, yeah, their stock is up over recent time anyway. If they want to own too many radio or television stations in a market or whatever, or if they want to, suspend the Sherman Act
right.
to buy one more company, they shouldn't have a problem. Or if they want Jeb Bush to give another tax break.
Right. One other set of numbers that I saw over the weekend was that the GOP plans to spend $70 million on the congressional elections.
Yeah.
And it admits that 90% of that is going towards negative advertising. And they have an army of investigators out right now trying to dig dirt on Democratic candidates. And to admit that openly in a Wire story, I just found that so disgusting.
They brag about it because they know that the vast majority of Americans are only engaged politically in the last few weeks before the election. And even then, because we have had 15, 20 years of infotainment in the United States, most people don't even remember what real news sounds like or looks like or reads like. Because it's all infotainment all the time. Political races in the United States are dealt with like horse races or sporting events. And
yeah, well, I think Dems need to get down in the trenches and do the same thing. I know here in Oregon, in the race for governor, the Republican candidate is, there's a lot to be said about him that his opponent is not saying that could be said.
Yeah.
You're talking about Greg Walden? Pardon?
Are you talking about Greg Walden?
No, I'm talking about Ron Saxton.
Oh, Ron Saxton, the guy who's running for governor. Oh, yeah.
Right.
There's no chance he's going to win. I mean, he's been on every side of the issues, every one of the right wing sides anyway. And,
well, I know that.
Mary Starrett running against him.
He's a Republican. His dad's up.
Well, he's not the only one. I mean, Mike Erickson, who's running against Darlene Hooley, who's my member of Congress here in Oregon. I've seen his ads. I've seen his website. In fact, I tried to get him on the local program. And said, I won't pick on you. Let's just talk about the issues. He won't come on the program, but he doesn't admit it. None of it says he's a Republican. This is what I was predicting a year ago, Fred, was that the Republicans, that Bush wants to not get impeached, Cheney doesn't want to get impeached or go to prison, and Rove doesn't want to go to prison, and all of these guys are complicit in violations of the Constitution, high crimes and misdemeanors, if not war crimes, and the only way they can prevent there from being impeachments and trials is to hold on to their power in the House and Senate. And so they are going to authorize, and it's happening right now, they're going to authorize the Republicans in the House and Senate to run against George Bush. And it's already begun. It's already begun. You got Chuck Hagel out there going, I don't think he's a good man, like that. They're throwing all this money in Lincoln Chafee's race. Why would they do that? That's why. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Oh, man, what a day, what a day, what an absolutely incredible day. Here it is, 9/11. Five years ago yesterday, I was flying home from Australia, stuck in Australia, and incredibly sick. I'd come down with some Australian form of cholera or something, and I was supposed to fly home on 9/11, on September 11th. 2001, and because I'd been doing this like two and a half week tour of the country on behalf of the publisher there, Bantam Doubleday Dell, that had just published Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I was just like really sick, and so I called the airline. I was going to spend an extra day in Sydney and just travel around, visit, stay with some friends. And I was just living on bananas and tea. And I called the airline and I said, can I get an early flight out? And they said, yeah, we can put you on a flight leaving on the 9th that arrives in the United States on the morning of the 11th. I guess you lose the international date zone or whatever it was. So I arrived in Vermont, which is where I was living at the time, at about 6 o'clock in the morning, because you fly all night, from Australia to Los Angeles, and then the flight from Los Angeles to Chicago, and then from Chicago to Burlington, Vermont. And Louise picked me up at the airport at 6, and we got home, and I laid down and passed out, and I fell asleep, and I remember waking up that afternoon to the ongoing events of 9/11. It's that kind of thing that I guess most all of us remember, but amazing stuff. Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the rise.
The following developments in Iraq, September 11th. This is provided to us by Reuters News Service. Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported on Monday, as of 6:30 Greenwich Mean Time, Baghdad, a suicide bomber killed 11 people and wounded 3 as he boarded a minibus full of army recruits. In Kut, gunmen killed policeman Hassan Radi El Azawi when they attacked his house in the city of Kut. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was shot dead by insurgents north of Baghdad. In Hindiyah, police say they found a man's head in the Hindiyah Dam just west of the city of Hila. The identity of the victim was not clear. In Iskandaria, gunmen killed a civilian outside his home in that town. And in Hila, militants killed one person in the mainly Shiite city of Hila. The identity of the gunmen and of the victims were not clear. This note I got from Jim, one of our listeners. He says, maybe some grist for the mill that you could have researched. Found this on the web concerning Disney's reaction to Michael Moore's film. This is a quote from a news report that ran back some years ago. Weeks before the premiere, the controversy over Fahrenheit 9/11 has already begun. Parent company Disney ordered Miramax not to distribute the film due to its partisan nature. Despite the fact that Harvey Weinstein had already contributed $6 million to the production costs. After several weeks of arbitration, Miramax co-founders Harvey and Bob Weinstein, through the Fellowship Adventure Group, a new special-purpose company, personally acquired rights to the film and will arrange for its theatrical and home video distribution. Lionsgate Entertainment Group and IFC Films, major players in the arena for independent movies, will release Moore's film to theaters and cable television networks. Showtime will handle the sale of rights for pay TV. Yeah. I guess you can be anti-partisan before you can be partisan, notes Jim. So we'll see how this thing plays. This also, the Wall Street Journal running a piece and an interview between editorial page writer Paul Guigeau and President Bush that Social Security, 2007, Bush fully expects. Well, here he won't stop talking about it. This, by the way, from the Coffee House, No Decaf Served, the Coffee House, the TMPCafe.com blog, Josh Marshall's blog. He says he won't stop talking about it. Bush, privatizing Social Security has always been Bush's central domestic policy goal. I would remind you, by the way, this is what he ran on in 77? I believe it was the election of 78 when he ran for United States House of Representatives from Texas and lost. The only, you know, his first election he lost. Anyway, he won't stop talking about it. Privatizing Social Security has always been Bush's central domestic policy goal, and he knows 2007 is his last and best chance so long as Republicans hold control of Congress. It's no accident he raises the issue in an interview with conservative columnist Guigeau. The White House doesn't want to broadcast his interest in phasing out Social Security, but they very much do want to create what amounts to a paper trail so that after a potential Republican victory in 2006, which my good friend Mark Crispin Miller says is inevitable because they are going to rig the game, they're going to throw people off the voting rolls, they're going to rig the machines, and then they're going to say, oh, it's all because Karl Rove was so brilliant in scaring people. Anyhow, but they very much want to create what amounts to a paper trail so that after a potential Republican victory, they can argue that they contested the election on the basis of privatization and their win gives them a mandate. Yeah. Speaker Nancy Pelosi, that's not going to happen, snaps the president. This is from the Wall Street Journal interview. Democrats taking over. That's not going to happen, snaps the president of the United States, leaning across his desk in his airborne office. He's on Air Force One. He had been saying that he hoped to revisit Social Security reform next year, that he will be able to drain the politics out of the issue. And I rudely interrupted by noting the polls predict Mrs. Pelosi's ascension. I just don't believe it, the president insists. I believe the Republicans will end up running the House and the Senate. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just like, I remember doing election coverage on, what was it, November 2nd, as I recall, or November 4th? I think it was November 2nd was Election Day in 2004. And I was Ken Squire, who owns WDEV in Vermont, an affiliate that carries our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday. Ken Squire and a good friend, Ken and his wife Elizabeth, Ken had invited me to show up at his station on election night and do election coverage with him. And so he and I did election coverage from around 7 p.m. until what turned out to be around 1 a.m. And I remember around 10:30, 11 o'clock Eastern time, this is Vermont, it was Eastern time, the AP carried a story in which the AP reporter said, here was the story. The AP reporter said that Karen Hughes had just sat George W. Bush down and informed him that according to the exit polls, he had lost Ohio and several other key states, and that John Kerry had a significant majority of the votes, a multi-million vote majority, and that therefore John Kerry would be the next president of the United States. And she said, and the reporter said that Bush took the news without response and went off to bed. And I thought, that's really strange, or left the room or whatever he did. And 30 minutes later, the Associated Press report came down without any reference to the fact that Karen Hughes had been there and told him that he'd lost, and announced that, in fact, the Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell of Ohio, by coincidence, chairman of the Bush for Ohio Committee, co-chairman, the Ohio Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, had announced that Bush had taken Ohio and thus had won the election. So what are they planning this time? And could it be that they'll just blame it on this ABC mockudrama? This from the International Herald Tribune, the Asian Pacific edition. Hong Kong, three factories in southern China that make Disney merchandise allegedly underpay their workers, overwork them, and only selectively buy health or accident insurance for their employees, a survey released Sunday says. The survey, based on workers with all three factories, said all three factories pay below the minimum wage. In one, they pay 43 cents an hour. In another, pay 28 cents an hour. And in another, 51 cents an hour. Actually, they're all paying below that. That is the minimum wage in these three provinces. Yeah. The report said workers at all three factories worked overtime, ranging from 60 to 136 hours per month in violation of Chinese law, which only allows 36 hours of monthly overtime. In a statement, the Walt Disney Company, Asia Pacific Limited, did not discuss the allegations, did not address the allegations in detail. Well, but their stock is up, so they must be doing something right. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. George Bush doesn't think that way. He'd rather lead with everyone afraid than handle things the American way. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And the Bush administration, of course, you got to be worried, very worried about them. And they want you to be very afraid, all fear all the time. Yes, indeed. Senator John McCain, the Something Progress, repeated his false assertion yesterday that most Americans oppose a timetable for Iraq withdrawal, but which is a lie. Most Americans want a timetable for Iraq withdrawal. Most Americans oppose immediate withdrawal. I mean, if you're going to have Republican talking points, at least get them right, right? But John McCain, and then he goes on to say, he says, he calls Americans schizophrenic. He says, Americans are really kind of schizophrenic about this issue. They're frustrated, and they want us to get out, but if we ask the American people, should we set a certain date or calendar, they agree with the president and with me and with Dan that it's a recipe for disaster. We have to have conditions on the ground that indicate we can withdraw, end quote. Sorry, most Americans don't want us to stay the course, Mr. McCain. Most Americans, according to all polls, this isn't any particular, you know, Republican or Democratic poll, according to all polls, say, no, time to get out. Time to get out. You know, the simple fact of the matter is, no country likes being occupied. To quote George W. Bush, no country likes to be occupied. Or was it Don Rumsfeld? I'm pretty sure it was Bush who said it. And then, of course, on Friday, the Senate Intelligence Committee, signed off by all its members, including the Republican Pat Roberts, you know, one of the great cover-up artists of all times, comes out and says there's no connection whatsoever. There was no connection whatsoever between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. In fact, Saddam Hussein hated Al-Qaeda. He saw them as a threat to his power. He did everything he could to get them out of the country, to keep them out of the way. And yet Dick Cheney comes on and lies about it. I mean, just a bald-faced lie on Meet the Press. And isn't it a tragedy? Isn't it a shame that in today's world that we've reached the point where a vice president can go on a national so-called news infotainment program and tell a lie and not get it shoved down his own throat? I mean, this would not have happened during the era of Eisenhower or of Kennedy or of Nixon or of Johnson or of even Jimmy Carter, and certainly not during Bill Clinton's presidency. Here's Dick Cheney lying about this.
You've got Iraq and al-Qaeda, testimony from the director of CIA that there was indeed a relationship.
Nope.
Zarqawi in Baghdad, etc. Then the Thursday committee said that there was no relationship. In fact, Saddam, I haven't seen the report. I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
But Mr. Vice President, the bottom line is
we know that Zarqawi, running a terrorist camp in Afghanistan prior to 9/11, after we won the 9/11, then fled and went to Baghdad and set up operations in Baghdad in the spring of 2002 and was there from then basically until the time we launched into Iraq.
So there you go. Dick Cheney shoveling it out, just shoveling it out. Yeah, Zarqawi was running a program up in the north in the no-fly zone where we were protecting him. But Osama bin Laden, excuse me, Saddam Hussein, have I been saying Osama bin Laden through this whole riff? Saddam Hussein, see, they've done it to me. Holy cow, David. They got me. Say that again. What? They got me.
You.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's Saddam Hussein actively and aggressively hated Al Qaeda. He did not want them in his country. And if we had not been protecting this guy up in the Northern Territory, he would have been toast. So there's Dick Cheney, like Condi Rice. Same thing. She's got her little lie set here.
What the president and I and other administration officials relied on, and you simply rely on the Central Intelligence, the Director of Central Intelligence. George Tenet gave that very testimony, that in fact there were ties going on between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime going back for a decade.
Nope.
Indeed, the 9/11 Commission talked about contacts between the two.
Nope.
We know that Zarqawi was running a poisons network in Iraq. We know that
nope.
Zarqawi ordered the killing of an American diplomat in Jordan from Iraq. There
nope.
were ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. The contacts were Al-Qaeda saying to Saddam Hussein, hey, you want to do business? And Saddam Hussein saying, get the hell out of here, buddy! Or words to that effect. I mean, it's just Condi Rice just pulling this stuff out of her armpit or something. I mean, it's incredible. It's the right wing talking. These guys think if they can rewrite history, and frankly and tragically, there's some truth to it. Was it Goebbels who said, or was it Machiavelli? I don't know who the philosopher, the famous, he who controls history controls the future. But they are doing absolutely everything they can to rewrite the history of the situation in Iraq prior to our invasion. And now, with the help of their handmaidens over at Disney, they're doing everything they can to rewrite what happened during the Clinton administration. I mean, making stuff up and putting it on the air. It doesn't get any worse than that. We are living in an age of propaganda. It's gone beyond bad news. It's now propaganda. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tag your ears.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, toll-free all across the fine United States right here on your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You can also drop into our live chat room or participate in our message board and blog it over at tomhartman.com as well, or tomhartman.org, actually. We'll get you there as well. So Cheney, Rice, lying to the American people on Meet the Press yesterday. Isn't it amazing? Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mind-boggling, huh, Gary?
Hi, Tom. Just perfect. That's exactly what I called off. Not only, and correct me if I, not only did he say that, but to me is almost as bad or worse than that was he said if they had it all over again, they would do the same thing again.
Yeah. Well, because it gets them political capital. I mean, these guys are interested in keeping power. And what we have to understand, and this was, I think, probably the big carry-home message from my book signing over at Vox Pop over the weekend in New York. And what, when you're in a room with people, you're looking at their faces and you can see it when they get this, oh my God, I'd never realized that look on their face, And I've been saying this on the air for years, but I don't think I say it enough. What you have to understand is that these people really and true, and by these people, I'm talking about Cheney and Bush and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld, all these right-wing ideologues, They actually believe they're doing the best thing for America. They consider themselves great American patriots. They love this country just as much as you and I do. Their vision of how it should be is different than ours. Their rationale and their reasons are different than ours, but they think that they're doing the right thing. In fact, they so think that they're doing the right thing that even if it involves lying to achieve their ends, that the ends justify the means. And that as long as we make cartoon characters out of them, as long as we vilify them, as long as we say, oh, it's just a them, you know, whether and I'm guilty of this from time to time too. I mean, I particularly do it with people who live on dividends. You know, you're sitting on your butt by the pool waiting for your dividend. Well, there's a lot of people who are decent people who live on dividends. The bottom line is, as long as we simply turn these people into cartoon characters and vilify them and fail to actually understand them, take them seriously, and frankly, give them some respect, we will never be able to do a decent job of actually challenging their ideas and having the kind of debate and dialogue that the United States desperately needs and that the democracy desperately needs in order for it to go forward. And that will cause the American people to understand what they're really thinking, what we're really thinking. Let's get it out of the sound bites and the cliches and the straw men and talk about what's really going on here. And we can't do that if we're just sitting around calling each other names.
Are you still there?
Yeah, go ahead.
I do agree with that, and it was very well spoken. I would just add to this, and not to take away from anything that you just said, what I'm really concerned about, maybe I don't articulate it as good as I should, but I'm really concerned at some point, and the point is now, that we have to take responsibility, get informed, and get out there and change the House. If we don't change the House in the presidency this time around, I'm sorry, I don't have great optimism. I'm not optimistic about the future course of our country.
I agree with you, Gary. This is probably This is probably the most important election.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I absolutely understand what you're saying.
A lot of times they play, if you will, sometimes maybe the American people are a little gullible.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, Paul. I agree with you, Gary. This is probably the most important election of our lifetime, and if not, then the 2008 one certainly will be. It's right up there. And keep in mind the strategy of the right, as Paul Weyrich, the Republican conservative, speaking to a group full of folks and Republicans in a church, said so clearly and so openly.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go. And so they're going to do everything they can to reduce the voting populace, whether it means throwing people off the rolls like Ken Blackwell did with 300,000 people in Ohio in the last election, or Jeb Bush did in the 2000 election with 90,000 people in Florida, or whether it means calling people and telling them that the vote is on Wednesday instead of Tuesday if you live in a particular precinct, as was done all across the country, or whether it means sending people out, phony voting registration people, where they set up tables and booths and say, would you like to register to vote? You fill in the thing. If you click the box that says, I want to vote in the Democratic primary, they tear it up and throw it away. Whether it means having you think that you're signing a petition when, in fact, you're signing to re-register to vote as a Republican, so if you show up for the Democratic primary, you can't be there, or whether it means all these strategies, or whether it means rigging the voting machines, all of these various strategies that they're going to use, or perhaps, frankly, most important, negative campaigning, where they run these awful, awful, awful negative campaigns against pretty much anybody, and the goal of the negative campaign isn't to get you to vote for their candidate. It's to get you to not vote. It's the thing I think most Americans don't realize. The main goal of negative campaigning is to cause people not to bother showing up at the polls, to cause them to think, to hell with them all. They're all bumps, and not show up at the polls. And not only do we have to show up at the polls, but we have to show up at the candidate's office and say, hey, you want somebody to walk four blocks for you? I'll do it. and go door to door and hang door hangers on the doorknobs or knock on the doors and talk to people, I'll do it. You need somebody to man the phone banks, I'll do it. Show up at the county Democratic meetings every month and say, you know, yes, I'm here. Yes, I'll volunteer for a committee. By the way, maybe I'd like to run for chairman of the committee. Or I'll help, you know, get involved. Get involved. John in Marysville, Washington. Hey, John, you think I'm wrong?
Hey, Tom. Right next to a truck, just as you pull me on. Let me speed up a little.
Well, you want
bit.
Me to put you on hold and bring you back in a minute?
No, I'm past him now.
Okay.
Yeah, I just had to call. I love you, man. I think you're great. I love everything you do. But this stuff about Bush and Cheney and all their gang, these bunch of gangsters, all we have to do is understand that they love the country as much as we do, and they think they're doing the right thing. I'm sorry, Tom, but so did Hitler. So did Mussolini. What we need to
they
do
did.
Is inform people.
They did, John. Hitler and Mussolini really believed their own rhetoric. They actually
right.
believed their own rhetoric. And that was one of the big problems. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year. I talked to a lot of Germans, and they said, oh, well, you know, I said, why didn't you stand up? Why didn't you do something? Oh, because everybody just figured he was a silly little man with a mustache. He looked like a cartoon character. Everybody made fun of him. We never took him seriously. You've got to take these guys seriously. And if you don't believe that they actually have some kind of a belief structure, that they can actually go to bed at night with some sort of congruence, some sort of intellectual and emotional and political congruence, if you don't believe that, you can't take them seriously. You can't take them seriously. You can't defeat them.
But I do. I take them seriously, Tom. But what we've got to do is educate the people as to what they are.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
The fact is, it can all add up. It can all add up to they believe in what they do, and they believe they can lie, cheat, steal, and do whatever else in the name of what they call a god.
And they do.
But in the end, they're evil. That's what these people are. They're fascist, and they're evil. And that's what they've done to this world.
Here's where we get to the problems of definitions. I mean, they're basically taking the same position that Edmund Burke did in the 1790s, that John Adams did in the late 1790s, that Alexander Hamilton did in 1787 when he stood up and gave his opening speech before the Constitutional Convention and said we should emulate aristocracy because there's never been a more stable form of government formed. They believe that a small ruling elite with the appearance of democracy but without the reality of democracy will produce the most stable kind of country, and that instead of a ruling elite that is hereditary, like they have in Europe, that we should have a ruling elite that is a meritocracy. In other words, it's Calvinism reinvented. You know, God's blessing is demonstrated by riches. The people who have the most money are the people that God loves the most. And these guys believe this belief system. And instead, if we simply call them evil, you're going to get people from the
other side
going, wait a minute, my guy isn't evil.
No.
But when you expose how they're thinking and you expose what they're saying, then you get people from the other side going, well, I don't think that way.
Yeah,
and then we can wake up people.
But the biggest thing about it is they're liars, they're thieves, they're killers, and they're gangsters. That's what they are. Okay?
I won't disagree with any of those characterizations, John. But those characterizations are also not the core of what they are. At the core, what they are is conservatives. And they're conservative.
Oh, I don't
believe
that, Tom. I don't believe they're conservatives, Tom.
How are you defining conservatives, John? John? Oh, the phone just croaked. Okay, we lost John. I'm sorry, John. If you mean that they're not conservatives and the mold of Barry Goldwater and Dwight Eisenhower and Everett Dirksen, I agree with you. I agree with you. Those guys weren't conservatives either, I would say, in the classic mold. If you want to know true conservative philosophy, go pick up a copy of Russell Kirk's book in 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, which is, by the way, the book that got Barry Goldwater started and that got William F. Buckley started and has been essentially the Bible. And his opening chapter is about Sir Edmund Burke in the UK. Sir Edmund Burke, who said, I'm paraphrasing now, he said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as hairdresser or tallow maker, candle maker. No problem if they have that job. But it does considerable violence to society if such a man is allowed to participate in governance. In other words, to vote, to run for office. Russell Kirk in 1953 saying, a society must have orders and classes. That religion must be used as a way of controlling the way people think. That's conservative. 45 minutes past the hour.
Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back 9.5 minutes before the hour. Let me just lay this right out. There's two kinds of cons that we have to be that we're dealing with here. We have the opportunist cons. You got the people who are just like taking advantage of whatever they can to make as much money as they can or get as much power as they can. Who are you know sick and twisted and mentally ill and doing extraordinary damage to this country. And frankly, I would put at the top of that list right now, tragically, certainly Dick Cheney, and probably and George W. Bush, and many in their corporate support group. But then you've got the guys who made it all possible for these guys, and Karl Rove, I'd toss him in that category as well. But then you've got the guys who made it possible for all these guys, who cheered them on, who said, "No, here's what you've got to do. If we can take Iraq as a tabula rasa, as a blank slate, and we can just rewrite the Constitution and make everything new and everything work, and we can figure all this stuff out, let's just rewrite the Constitution and go with a 15% flat tax, and we'll just corporations can do anything they want, and here in the United States." It's only maximum 15% tax for people who earn their livings from dividend income, and let's do tax cuts, even though it's going to throw the country $4-5 extra trillion in debt, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The enablers, they're true believers. You know, they've read too much Ayn Rand. They've read too much. They believe this stuff. And I agree with our last caller. It's entirely appropriate to call the thieves, and to call the people who are doing, who are stealing from us as people who are, and the killers. Yeah, I am horrified by the fact that George W. Bush delighted in being the governor who killed more people, as executed more people as governor than any other governor in the history of the United States, that over 100,000 people have died in Iraq, and he seems not to consider it. But the whole idea of just a little collateral damage in Lebanon, you know, no big deal to Condoleezza Rice. I am horrified by that. And yes, I think those folks are sick and twisted. But the vast majority of the so-called conservatives in the United States, or actually of the real old-fashioned conservatives in the United States, are looking for a society that is not unstable, that a society is not in upheaval, a society that is safe and secure and where the future is predictable and where we're never again going to have, you know, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and we're never again going to have African Americans in the streets saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we want our rights." We're never going to have women standing up saying, "We want reproductive rights and equal rights in the workplace." Never again going to have students standing up saying, "We're not going to go to your stinking wars." They want an America that is like Europe in the Victorian era. That's the conservative model. The true conservative model. Classes and orders. A caste system in the United States. Granted, a meritocracy, but a caste system. They want to do away with social mobility. It's why they want to defund higher education. They want to make it so that if anybody who's not born of wealth actually manages to make it to college, that they're an indentured servant for at least the first 10 years of their lives thereafter. There's a reason for that, and the reason is that they think that produces a more stable America. And until we start talking about the reasons, and not just the effect, not just the evil and damage that it's doing, but the reasons why they're doing it, we're not going to have the kind of debate and discussion in this country that's going to allow us to undo it. See, back in the 40s and 50s, everybody understood this. Franklin Roosevelt came right out and said, you know, we've got to take these people on. They claim that we're trying to bring down America, bring down the institutions of America. And we're not. We're going after their power. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt just laid it right flat out back in 19 1936, July 27th of 1936, when he accepted his second nomination for President of the United States in Philadelphia. And he said, you know, new use of corporations have created conditions that the founders never dreamed of. And he says, you know, he lays it out very straight. And he says, and new economic royalists have emerged from this. And they're reaching out and thirsting for control of government itself.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
You see, as much as things go around, they go around. I mean, we're right back there again. Roosevelt saying this, and again, they're wrapping themselves in the flag and the Constitution.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
Again, it's the same playbook.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And that's why it's so important that we have groups like the ACLU out there speaking out and saying, no, this is what the flag and the Constitution, it stands for freedom, for liberty, for the freedom of speech, for no more of these free speech zones, for no more rigged elections, for no more of this stuff. Time to take back America. And it's only going to happen if we get politically active. 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks for being with us today. Remember, my friends, democracy, activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.